Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
If your 5-year-old special needs son just wandered off into the night, would you A, immediately sound the alarm, or B, get yourself smashed on some drugs? Answers on a postcard.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Let's talk about the details of this case. So bear in mind, Elijah was 5 years of age when his life came to an end. He also had developmental issues, he had mental health issues, and it seems that having these vulnerabilities actually incentivized the abuse towards him. You know, his primary caregivers who were meant to give him that extra loving care, they actually saw his issues as a bit of a problem, a bit of a bind, a bit of a burden, and they sought to alleviate that burden from themselves in the most horrendous of ways. And bear in mind, one of the things that is absolutely dreadful about this case is that DCYF never intervened or properly investigated when people were raising the alarm. In fact, the abuse and neglect became so severe that I'm talking about this case because Elijah sadly died in September 2021 at 5 years of age. And the absolute horror that child went through is so unforgivable that one day, I genuinely hope that both of the perpetrators are shown similar, shall we say, in the afterlife when it comes down to the torture and abuse that they receive. So let's talk about our two main perpetrators. So Daniel Denise Dauphiné, she was born on June 12th, 1986. And when you look at the background of her life, the backdrop of who she was and what created her, certainly she had instability, she had trauma, and she had emotional struggles. She grew up between Massachusetts and New Hampshire. She basically shuffled a lot between one address and another, and that causes destabilization. You don't have the opportunity to create good relationships often because you're moving a lot. So with respect, her childhood was marked by chaos rather than calm and care. Now, two of her former stepmothers, they later actually told reporters that it's true that her early years were literally laced with conflict. She was estranged from her actual biological mum, and her relationship with her father was really fraught. It was very volatile. And as she gets older, she ends up going into care. So she's spending periods in group homes. And I think psychologically, that can be very brutal for children. The idea that at the end of every day, you are closing the door and that door belongs to the authorities because you are no longer in the care of your caregivers. It's just a very cold experience to go through. It feels very destabilizing. You can feel very abandoned. And of course, it is not perfect for any child to be brought up in such conditions. Understandably, like so many kids that go into care, she doesn't want to stay in care very often. She doesn't like it. She'd repeatedly run away from there. And people who knew her said that one of the things that was very clear about her from the early years of her teens is that she just didn't like boundaries. She pushed boundaries again and again and again. But it's worth mentioning that the children who do go into the care system, very often they will push boundaries because they haven't had that safety around them. They haven't had clear instruction. They haven't been lovingly given rules. You know, at the end of the day, they are testing situations as well because they've lost their sense of safety in their original environment. They start believing that maybe nobody wants them. So they end up pushing boundaries that proves that correct, i.e. I can prove that I am unworthy by making sure that you also abandon me. This is something that we see as a cycle very, very regularly. But also, it could mean that she does have a problem understanding how appropriate she should act in certain situations. And even as a young teen, she's doing things like sneaking out. She's taking cars without permission, which is a high level offence. Of course it is. I mean, you can kill people when you get into somebody's car that you're not qualified to drive. And it shows poor consequential thinking as well. She's also drifting between households. And people said, to some degree, they also noted that within her psyche, there was a darker side of her nature. that there was something about her where her behavior turned quite negative and dark that worried the adults around her. They felt that there was something of a premonition there, that she had this capacity to do bad things, even though there was an understanding that her life had been chaotic and problematic, and therefore there was a collateral damage on the way that she acted. There was this sense that it ran deeper than just dealing with that symptomatic behaviour of a difficult life. Now, despite this, some people who were around said, you know, she was somebody who's quite bubbly, she was sweet, she's relatively eloquent when you hear her in interviews, being interrogated by the police, for example, she's very much able to string a sentence together. So she has a good comprehension of the English language and a good way of expressing it. Now, one former stepmother called Danielle, she said that she remembered sitting beside her watching television, and she said that she was one of those people who just get completely absorbed in the stories where fantasy heroes rescued their beloveds. So there was a romantic side to her actual mindset. There was a romantic side to her belief system. You know, she was hoping probably to have that hero gallop into her life, whip her up on the horse and take her away from her issues, because she was obviously struggling a great deal in many different ways. And that's not to in any way excuse what we're going to talk about today, but just to note that that connection with fantasy was probably something that she used to alleviate some of her personal emotional distress. Now, according to people, one of the things about that romantic nature is that it stayed with her and she clung to that idea of romantic salvation, but it doesn't work out that way. So that hero doesn't come in. Prince in armor doesn't dash into her world and save her from herself and her situation. And instead, by the time she reaches her mid-20s, she already has 3 kids by 2 different fathers. Now, lots of people do that. They thrive. But if you have had 3 children by your mid-20s and you've had 2 dysfunctional relationships that have broken down, the reality is that you're in a scenario where economically you're going to struggle more, emotionally you're going to potentially struggle more, environmentally you're going to potentially struggle more, and certainly on a freedom level you're going to struggle more, because it's tiring having children, and whilst it's a blessing on every level for most people, it's challenging even when you want your kids, enjoy your kids and adore your kids. And this situation doesn't work well for her, so she ends up giving up or losing custody of all of those 3 children. Now,
happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
In 2013, this is when she's 27 years of age, she, shall we say, is continuing on her journey and path in hope that she might meet her Prince Charming. And Dauphiné marries Timothy, known as Tim Lewis. Now, that's in Nashua in New Hampshire. But it's not, shall we say, a honeymoon period for very long. So within just 6 months, police end up getting called to their Merrimack home, and officers at this point found Danielle bleeding from cuts on her torso. She actually tells them at this point that Tim was intoxicated. He lifted her and then he pushed her down a stairwell, which is absolutely harrowing, particularly as they're meant to be young love's dream, being that they've only just got married. The idea that somebody would pick you up and throw you down a stairwell is terrifying, because it could kill you. Somebody who can engage in that level of domestic abuse could certainly cause your death. Also, I think we've got to see this relationship in the backdrop to her losing her children as well, because the emotional collateral and damage of having kids taken away from you, you either have to be an absolute psychopath of the highest level, which she may be, or you are going to be emotionally broken by the loss of these kids. And that means that ultimately you'll be seeking some kind of reassurance, some deflection, anything that will take you away from the agony of that loss. So when she meets him and gets involved with him, the likelihood is that she likes the intensity. She likes the fact that she feels wanted and seen and validated and required and needed, and all those things can fill that space temporarily, of course, of the kids that have been removed from you. Unless, of course, you are indeed a psychopath, which, like I said, she may very well be. But that incident itself, high level as it may have seemed, it doesn't result in a conviction for either of them.
Now, that same year, in August 2013, Dauphiné is arrested for driving whilst intoxicated in Hudson, New Hampshire. Now, that tells us a story. It tells us a story of someone who doesn't consequentially think, who does what she wants, even if it puts other people at danger. I've got absolutely no time whatsoever for people who get into cars when they are under the influence. They are potential killers in movement. It's as simple as that. And the fact that she's willing to do that suggests that she's not really learned anything about her past behaviour that has caused her the issues that she's faced, and again suggests that boundaries mean very, very little to her. Now, it's not long after this particular incident that she and Tim Lewis move across the country to Mesa, Arizona. And then in 2016, the happy event that should have been is that they have a little boy, Elijah. But it doesn't take long after his birth for the marriage to deteriorate completely. In fact, less than 2 weeks after Elijah's first birthday, Tim Lewis files for divorce. And at this point, Dauphiné makes a decision to move back to New Hampshire. Now, her ex described her as violent, impulsive, and having a history of domestic violence and substance abuse. I appreciate we're only getting one side of the story. There is a strong likelihood as well that he was violent towards her at points, but I do not doubt him for 1 minute. Having understood the history of this case and researched this case, I can tell you this woman has violence running through her veins. And he also alleged that she'd abandoned their son by leaving Arizona for the East Coast once she'd returned to New Hampshire. Now, at this point, she basically just drifts and drifts from place to place, from relationship to relationship. And again, that's very reflective of her experience growing up. You know, she never felt that level of security when she was in care, and she mimics that experience as an adult. The relationship to relationship, again, that plays into that romanticized idea of possibility that maybe this relationship will work, or maybe this one will be different this time. And we see that pattern very often where people have got incredibly poor attachment and they're looking for something to fill that void. Now, family members who knew her said that she was constantly, quote, running wherever she went. So she arrives somewhere, thinks, brilliant, this is going to be my new life. This is going to be my new start. This is going to be a new opportunity. And then because she is the problem, she's carrying the problems with her. She's not resolving them. She's not dealing with them. She's not attending to any of them. She just carries those issues wherever she goes. And for a period of time, she can deflect from those challenging feelings. You know, she can meet a new guy and that relationship can fill that void, and she can move to a new place and that can fill the void. Anything that can take the eye off the reality of what she needs to explore, which are those internal fractures. Now, it's during this period, it's around late 2017 into 2018, that Danielle meets Joseph Stapf. Now, their relationship ignited really quickly. We expect this. When someone has the history that I've just described, we expect them to not put the brakes on. They should. They should be really thinking, I need some time and space by myself. I need to figure out what's broken and flawed within me. Most of us have got certain fractures from growing up. You need to attend to them so they don't play out in your long-term loving relationships. But for somebody like this, who's constantly cycled between one home and another, between one relationship and another, she just travels through them, often trashing things as she goes without attending to or healing the things that are causing the problems. And again, it's playing out with Joseph Stapf. She meets him, they get together, they fall for each other intensely because they are papering over the cracks within their psyche with their intense feelings. Love is like that. Lust is like that. You connect. You feel like this person is the most valuable person you've ever known. You're the most visible you've ever been. And it's intoxicating for like 5 seconds of your reality. And then, of course, those cracks begin to show. Now, bear in mind, her choice is that isn't excellent or ideal. He's got an extensive criminal history. These included burglary, theft, drug possession. There's actually one specific case in Marblehead, Massachusetts. This is where he was convicted of stealing crystal stones and high-powered ammunition. Just the kind of guy you want in your life. I mean, if I'm not wandering around thinking, what's the kind of guy I want? Well, I'd like somebody with high-powered ammunition and maybe some crystal. That would be great. But, you know, the very fact that he's stealing drugs and ammunition demonstrates that he is not ideal to have a good relationship with. He's clearly got his own baggage. And when you've got two sets of baggage that are pretty monumental, you're both going to get weighed down eventually. He'd also got another conviction in 2016. This is when a woman had gone to court seeking a protection order against him.
She actually told the judge that Stafford hit her numerous times over a 3-day period. So is violent towards women. Again, not ideal. Now, the court did actually grant a temporary order, but she ended up withdrawing the complaint the following day, so it never proceeded to a full hearing. But we see this again and again and again, where victims are convinced by the perpetrator to go ahead and withdraw those orders. And it's likely that's exactly what happened there. It's not as if he wasn't guilty. It's just he managed to convince her to drop the complaint. Now, one news report that I found described him as, quote, always keeping his beard impeccably groomed, his body draped in tattoos with a skull on his bicep and the words live free or die along his forearm, which, believe me, by the end of this case is going to sound quite ironic for him. Also, apparently he'd really cultivated this tough guy persona. So looks are important to him. The way his presence comes across is important to him. And part of that is he'll like to look intimidating. He'll like to be the kind of person that you're a little bit afraid of. And when you need to do that, it speaks usually of a deep insecurity and deep inferiority at core. Now, Staff very quickly moves Dauphiné into the basement of his mother's lakefront home in Merrimack, New Hampshire. So they've got together quickly, now they've moved in together quickly, and that's not ideal. And of course, what do we see on social media? Well, it's a picture of painted, procured, cultivated, beautiful bliss, isn't it? This happy, healthy relationship for everyone to see, with captions like, "This beautiful woman is my world." To which Daniel replied, "I'm so blessed to have you in my life." I mean, you know, you've seen it a million times, haven't you? The people who put it all out there. And you know, behind closed doors, it is an altogether different story. And that's exactly the case here. Behind this online persona of perfection, those who knew the couple actually said, yeah, I mean, not quite the story that we would tell. At the end of the day, they were constantly taking drugs. Their behaviour was totally erratic. There was regular police visits to the property. Why not pop that on Facebook? You know, I'd love that, would you? You know, you just open your Facebook page and you just notice that your friends post, "Oh, look, it's Joanne being caught on body cam shoplifting in Tesco." You know, that would be so much more fun, wouldn't it? "Oh, it's John and Amy. Yeah, he's just getting done for a restraining order right now because of the violence in their relationship. I don't know a John and Amy." I'm just saying, that would actually make people see the world a little bit more clearly, wouldn't it? At the end of the day, people put all these myths online, and very often you can't see the woods for the trees because you're just surrounded by this myriad of myths that people cultivate that actually have no basis in reality. Also, there was a lot of financial instability, situational and emotional chaos. So it's not ideal. And we always know, whether emotional problems, whether a drug use, whether there is financial instability, there's going to be high levels of stress. Where there's high levels of stress, we would see higher levels of violence if someone has a predisposition for that violence. We already know that both of them have got some level of violence within their nature because that's played out in prior experiences. So here we are with this perfect cooking pot of possibility with this couple who are living in this very fused state, in this small environment at his mother's home, and they're dealing with the chaos of their world, which is going to incentivize negative actions. Now, bear in mind, the financial instability was not helped by the fact that Dauphiné owed more than $19,000 in unpaid child support to the father of her first child, which she clearly hasn't paid. And that very same year, she's subject to an eviction order from a Nashua apartment. And even though this is all playing out, and you would imagine, I don't know, that maybe Dauphiné has got some kind of memo on, maybe parenting isn't for you. Now, despite all of the instability that I've just described, for some bizarre reason, Staff and Dauphiné don't get the actual memo on maybe thinking about putting the brakes on things like children. No, they end up having their first child together in 2019. It's a daughter who's reportedly born at home in Merrimack. And by May 2020, Dauphiné and Staff, who bear in mind are still living in the basement of his mother's home in Merrimack, which is not going to be ideal when you've got a young daughter with you, it turns out they're going to have a bigger issue because
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps, head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Elijah, her son, who's then 4 years of age, he ends up getting brought from Arizona to New Hampshire by his father. So his father, Timothy Lewis, had had enough. It's as simple as that. He'd had enough. Look, I will be talking about the failings of the mother in this case and the stepfather in this case, but I actually have issues with Timothy Lewis, the biological parent in this case as well, because he basically just turns up with Elijah, who he's had for this period of time, and just sees fit to dump Elijah on the biological mother who's shown no interest. She's abandoned him already. And he's happy to do that. Now, that disturbs me. I would not imagine ever doing something as damaging as taking a child that I've been bringing up and giving them to a parent they no longer know. That in itself is going to have devastating impact on Elijah, particularly as apparently he's been having developmental challenges and a difficult behavior pattern. Well, you want to make it worse? Just take them from everything that they know, dump them with someone they don't know, and imagine that they're going to thrive. Said no one ever. The reality is, doing that is going to be devastating and catastrophic for his mental health, for his emotional well-being, for his social experience, for all of the things that actually impact on childhood. Now, even though his biological father says he was a difficult kid, he was a challenging kid, he had mental health issues, there are other members of the family who said that he was a happy, energetic, silly boy. And like I said, no matter what was going on for Elijah, he should not have just been taken and dumped with the biological mother. And I appreciate that there are people out there saying, well, she is 50% of the issue. She should be willing to open her door to Elijah. She'd already had three kids removed. This is not a mother who should be having another child put with her because she's not actually capable of taking care of the ones that she lost. And she already has another toddler, so this is not going to be perfect for Elijah in any way, shape, or form. Now, when she gets Elijah, she's struggling from the get-go. But even though she is struggling, she resists any help, because friends later said that they had offered assistance, especially with Elijah in particular, but she just rejected or she withdrew from them. Instead, she just didn't want to engage. So after he's been moved to New Hampshire, there are opportunities, pockets of support she could have accessed, and she doesn't want to. It's as simple as that. She doesn't want people involved. She doesn't want prying eyes looking in. And the reason for that is probably multifold. First of all, she probably doesn't like people interfering because she felt that a lot of people interfered in her own upbringing and it didn't turn out well for her. Secondly, she wants to be able to do what she wants without judgment. And if that happens to be violence towards a child, well, you better bet your bottom dollar that she's going to want to go ahead and do that without people getting in the way. Now, you won't be surprised to know that after he's moved with her, somebody who's seemingly to some degree a stranger to him, he starts getting isolated from the extended family, from the extended friends, from the outside world. So all of his support strategies that could have been utilized, they're just disintegrating because he's not allowed access to any of them. And his dad, his biological father, later said that his difficult behavior pattern worsened since he'd moved back in with his mother. Yes, again, if you can see that happening, if it's playing out in real time, as the biological father, surely your job is to intervene. I know that you may have problems yourself, but if you can literally say you watched that happen, like some kind of slow real-time car crash, shouldn't you jump back in the driving seat and escort the vehicle to somewhere safe and then figure out what to do next? Because can we all be real about this? It isn't as if they have to be with the mother or a father if you're a child. You can be with the actual services that can protect you when your parents don't want you any longer. And believe me, for Elijah, it would have been better if you'd been handed over to the authorities. Now, bear in mind, as it plays out in court, this case, the lawyers actually said that he had severe psychiatric issues, but also noted that neither parent got him an evaluation. His father biologically apparently advocated that he wanted him to undergo an evaluation. But can we just be real here? You either got him an evaluation that said he had severe psychiatric issues or you didn't. You can't say, oh, we wanted to get one, we advocated to get one, but we didn't get one. And then say, but he had severe psychiatric issues. You know what severe psychiatric issues are because you've been evaluated and it's been classified. If that hasn't happened, it's just hyperbole. It's as simple as that. It's people just saying things that they believe that are not actually weighted in truth and evidence and fact. Now, one of the things really early on that friends of Dauphiné realized was that she was getting overwhelmed with the parenting responsibilities. Now, of course, that does not make her a bad person. Lots of people get overwhelmed with the parenting responsibilities. She's certainly been overwhelmed before. She's had three children either given up or removed from her care. So she's been through this. She can absolutely go ahead and speak to the authorities, have Elijah put into care, given a compassionate, loving family who might be able to actually give him some protection and compassion, or of course, negotiate some kind of responsibility with the biological father again. So she's been through this. If she is getting overwhelmed, it's perfectly acceptable to ask for help, but she's not doing that. Now, by the fall of that year, Elijah's dad has actually become concerned. So he believes that Elijah isn't getting proper medical care. He goes ahead at this point and contacts the state's Division for Children, Youth and Families. And he apparently tells the Child Services Agency that he can't take Elijah back because he's concerned for the safety of the other children living in his home. Again, I'm sorry, I'm not going to find a lot of sympathy and empathy for Elijah's biological father. You are willing to place that child in the care of a completely unfit mother who from the get-go is clearly not giving Elijah what he needs, but you're not going to take him back because it's going to impact on the other kids that you've got. I just have this sense of a heartbreak for Elijah. He needed to be loved and cared for compassionately. He needs to be protected and understood. And instead, it just seems like he's passed from pillar to post. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm really appreciative that the father in this case did speak to DCYF because at the end of the day, he was trying to get some kind of help for his son. But nonetheless, we're still left with a child who's basically been abandoned by both parties. We then get to November 2020, and here we have yet another unforgivable mistake. So he gets taken to the doctors, and at the doctor's office, it's shown that Elijah weighs 32 pounds. That's 14.5 kilograms. Also, the doctor notes he's got bruises on his face, on his eye, and his arm. His weight and bruising are all clear indicators of abuse, but it's basically unnoticed. Even though it's noted down, it's not taken anywhere. It doesn't go any further. This is despite the DCYF reports that his father's previously made. Those dots are not being joined together, and that's altogether fatal in this case. And whilst this is playing out, whilst clearly Elijah is struggling, another thing that Dauphiné is doing is she's actually speaking to relatives, including a sister, and also the biological aunt to Elijah, who she actually grew up with, and talking to them about the struggles that she had looking after him. In fact, she tells them that she felt like she couldn't provide care for him because he's got these behavioural problems. But to be fair, that's a very surface concern. We understand somebody struggling to provide care because a child's being very, very difficult, but this is on a much more dark plane. Because what people won't know when she's complaining about Elijah is that he's already subject to repeated abuse, to repeated neglect. They deprive him of food as a punishment. They leave him starved. And when you think about your very basic human needs, food is part of that. One of the most important things where children are concerned is to be nurtured. That's environmentally, to feel safe. It's socially, because you're protective within that network. It's on a food level and on a hydration level, because there are immediate needs that are met. It's about comfort. It's about security. It's about consistency. If you really want to make a child feel like they're in a totally hostile environment, you starve them. You prevent them meeting those very basic needs. And they are very basic needs, to just have a stomach that isn't completely empty. When you're withdrawing that kind of support, first of all, it's obviously highly dangerous, but the abuse isn't just about the physical torture and torment. It's about the psychological knowledge that you are being denied something basic and that you feel it on so many different levels. You feel it emotionally because it's the pangs of loneliness it creates. You feel it physically, it's the pang of hunger it creates. You feel it on a fear level because you don't know when your next meal is coming. And what we see when children are deprived of food is it changes their behavior massively. Often they become hyper-energetic, which seems bizarre, but certainly occurs. And they also try to become as sneaky as possible because they're desperate to try to get the food, which often results in them getting highly punished because
all they're trying to do is sneak around to try to get something that means they're not going to starve to death. And then that makes them seem like the bad person. And it gives a legitimate reason for the perpetrator to abuse them further. So that cycle is just so depriving on every single level possible. They were also abusing him physically. This is obviously shown by the bruising and the injuries that the doctors could see at the time that he was taken. And those injuries showed repeated trauma. Also, it turns out he's being exposed to fentanyl, which is a massively dangerous drug. We all know that fentanyl can be fatal at even tiny levels, but the belief is that she was actually doping him on purpose because she wanted to subdue him. He's not a problem if he's asleep. Doesn't matter how dangerous her actions might be, as long as she gets her space, then who cares? Also, it turned out that he was confined for really long periods of time in the bathroom tub. Often he'd be naked. He couldn't stand at times because he was so deprived of food. Also, they were monitoring him via video. Just let it sink in. We're talking about a 4 to 5 year old child at this moment in time. They are dots. They are tiny. And also, we're meant to believe that this kid is highly challenging in nature, very dangerous and violent to such a degree he can't be around other kids, problematic. Well, he can't be. He's literally been confined for long periods of time in the bathtub. He obviously knows how to behave when he's terrified. The fact that they humanize him on every single level, leaving him naked, meaning that he's actually being videoed, he's got absolutely no privacy. This doesn't sound like a child who's a problem. This sounds like a child who's literally being decided as the problem and is now being punished for something they're not guilty of in any way, shape or form. He's a kid, he's a 4 to 5 year old child, and he's being brutalized in this manner because they have got issues managing their own emotions, so it's easier to project onto him. And let's be clear, it's because the caregivers in this case, and I use that very, very lightly, they're bothered about their own world and their own lives, and he's just interfering within it, so he's going to be punished for that. The prosecutor actually later down the line said that Elijah was assaulted, starved, isolated, and neglected. They said he was tortured. And by the way, throughout it all, it's not as if staff is challenging Dauphinet on this. It's not like he's saying, listen, we've got to stop doing this. We really need to consider the reality that this could turn into a very dangerous situation. No, he just sides with her. I'm not saying that he enjoys what she's doing, but he certainly doesn't challenge her that much on it. Now we get to June 2021. This is when she ends up sending messages to a friend on Snapchat named Erica Wolf. And on this Snapchat, she's expressing that she's not only overwhelmed by him, but she's also claiming to be afraid of him. Now, listen, I get it. We can have situations where children can be very, very scary, particularly when they're teenagers, they've grown up, they've learned how to say no, they're a physical challenge to you, and also maybe they're having some serious issues. That could be very scary. A 5-year-old? Hey, they can kick hard, they can punch pretty hard, they can scream real loud, but they ain't no match for an adult. You can restrain a 5-year-old very, very easily. So the idea that you're afraid of him does not make sense as far as I'm concerned. Again, another excuse, another projection, another how could I blame him because I'm the problem, but I don't want to acknowledge that or tend to that. Instead, I'm just going to project all the issues onto Elijah. And definitely, she's very resentful of him. One message actually read, I call him the next Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer. So the suggestion that she's looking at him like a future serial killer, even though she's the one who's going to starve him and abuse him and leave him in a bathtub where he's not allowed to get out and video him to dehumanize him, apparently he's the problem. Just gonna throw it out there. You sound like a massive psychopath, mother, in this case. But again, she's not seeing that. She's not internalizing that reality. She's just not happy, so he's the problem, and she's gonna actually incentivize herself to be able to act this way because she's not dealing with a kid. She's not dealing with a 5-year-old. No, she's dealing with a potential serial killer, and a potential serial killer deserves to be treated badly. Can you see how the psychology plays into that mindset and permission base? Now, another text message said, I want him gone. She allegedly also said, it's so sad, but I have no connection with this child. His father took him at the age of 1 and never returned him until May 2020. He's been getting worse and worse. I want him gone.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I can't handle it anymore. You know what? I was not present at that time, but there's a really simple resolve to this. Walk in to child services, hand that child over and say, I'm not doing this anymore. They will deal with it. It's all you need to do. The bigger question is, why aren't you doing that? She's done it before. She's got rid of three other kids, so I had them removed from her. She understands the system. Just go ahead and relinquish your parental rights to Elijah. Why isn't she doing it? That's the question. Why is it distinct this time from the prior times? And there's a strong likelihood that she actually enjoys allowing herself to be violent to this child. She's enjoying the power. She's enjoying the control. She's enjoying going ahead and torturing this child. So even though she apparently wants him gone, she's not going to follow through and do the very things that she's aware would enable that to happen. She also made comments to that same friend about Elijah's behavior, saying, I have to keep him in his room and I can't trust him at all. He's five. You can't trust him at all. Kids at five have only just managed to start being deceptive. So we do tests with kids at three, tests with kids at five. At three, very rarely do they lie. Some kids will, the more developmentally advanced, the kind of more understanding and empathetic of their environment, but it's rarer. At five, you bet your bottom dollar, they all know that if they've done something wrong and they tell you that they didn't do it, there's a chance that they'll get away with it. It's about forming a sense of control over your environment. It's about figuring out who you are and the power you have over the world around you. It's completely typical. The idea that you can't trust him at all is ludicrous. And again, it speaks to her incapacity, intolerance and impatience with this child who is just five. Now, she also spoke on Snapchat about the state's child welfare agency and says that they are involved, but apparently they can't do anything without consent from Elijah's father. So she basically says these situations is a, quote, fucking nightmare that I can't wake up from. Now, again, I don't buy that whatsoever. The idea that the state's child welfare agency are involved but can't help because Elijah's father won't actually give consent. If she wants to give Elijah up, she could do that. It's as simple as that. And then the ball can be back in his park. If he doesn't want to engage or get help for Elijah, then he's going to have to deal with Elijah himself. But it feels like there is this kind of scenario where she's putting over this rock and a hard place that she's in, but it's just one that she's created, not one that's real. Now we get to late summer of 2021. At this point, Elijah's been confined, been starved, been beaten and drugged. Then on October the 10th, 2021, unbelievably, whilst he is being treated so horrifically, Dauphiné gives birth yet again at home to a boy. Now, her boyfriend, Steph, at this point, takes the infant to hospital because he's decided that he wants to leave him there. They're not going to be able to take care of multiple children, apparently. But when the boy is brought in to the hospital, they do some tests. Now, it's completely all right to surrender your child. We know that there are safe boxes, etc., where you can leave a child in certain states in the US, many states, in fact. However, those safe havens come with some kind of price, which is when they are attended medically, they check what's going on in the baby's body. And what happens is the hospital find evidence of drugs in the baby. So this then led to the hospital contacting child services because they now know that this child who's been surrendered has got drugs in the body and that the person who surrendered them may have other children, which could mean that those children were in danger. So this causes the agency to open an investigation. Now, on that very same day that staff surrendered the infant son, he actually texted his mother not bringing up Eli. So it's kind of indicating that he's not willing to be involved in Eli's life at first glance. But when the agency do some investigating to find out where Elijah is, they can't find him. They don't know where he is. In fact, what they're told initially is that he's gone to his auntie's in California. Then the mother claims that he's with a man, she said, with a brother in Texas. Now, it turns out that was just a friend of hers, but she calls him brother. So this investigation, it doesn't lead to any immediate action regarding Elijah, just a notable absence from him being at the primary caregiver's address. But then, after they go ahead and contact both of the relatives that's been indicated he's with,
they discover that Elijah isn't actually there. Now, initially, the guy that she called her brother, he lied. He went along with the lie that Elijah was with him, but he decided that he was going to come clean shortly afterwards because, I don't know, somebody knocked some sense into him by having a conversation such as, you'll be a co-conspirator in a very serious crime if Elijah isn't found. So he basically does the right thing, speaks to the authorities. Now we get to October the 14th. This is when New Hampshire DCYF alert authorities and Merrimack PD begin investigating that very same day. Now, shortly after, the New Hampshire police issue a missing child alert. Now, even though, of course, they are trying their best to figure out what on earth has happened to Elijah, they've not got a body at this moment in time. So they start suspecting as an authority that Elijah might not simply just be missing and something worse could have happened. But equally, they haven't found where the parents are at this moment in time because they're nowhere to be seen in New Hampshire. They've just disappeared. So the police end up holding this emergency press conference. They announce that Elijah's in danger. They announce that his parents are uncooperative because they've left where they're meant to be in New Hampshire. And they basically put people on high alert that they need to figure out where Elijah is and indeed where his primary caregivers are. Now, investigators very quickly discover that Dauphiné and staff have both stopped registering Elijah in school, in medical care, in daycare, or in fact, any public programs. Also, no neighbor, no teacher, no doctor, no relatives even seen Elijah in months. So they're starting to become even more concerned about what might have happened to Elijah. No one's seen him, no one knows where he is, and the caregivers aren't to be known or seen by anyone at this moment in time. Now, on October the 17th, this is as the search for Elijah is underway, Dauphiné and staff are finally arrested in the subway system of the Bronx, New York City. And at this point, even though they seem surprised, shall we say, that they're getting arrested. You know, we always get that, don't we, with these perpetrators. You know, the police arrive and like, why are we being arrested? We're being arrested because clearly you're on the run. Well, apart from the fact that we're being arrested for being on the run, why are we on the run? Well, we're hoping that you're going to tell us why you're on the run. I don't know. I don't know why I'm on the run. We're not even on the run. We're on the subway. We're just having a day out. Honestly, we see it all the time. So they're kind of resolute that they've got no idea what's happening. Like, although it's clear to see that neither of them had any drama school acting classes because they're really, truly awful when they are arrested. You can just tell they're making it up as they go along. Now, basically, they are charged at this point with witness tampering, child endangerment, and also failure to protect Elijah. But like I said, they haven't found Elijah. They don't know what's happened to Elijah. They just know he's not to be found at this moment in time, and also that they have lied about where he's meant to be. Now, Dauphiné is actually interviewed by the police on the very same day that she's arrested, and she basically begins by explaining when she began caring for Elijah, and she just goes straight in for the jugular. You know, this is a kid who's missing. Let's just bring that into sharp focus. This 5-year-old little boy is missing. You would imagine as a mother, if you realize that your child is still missing, no matter what you've had to do with his apparent disappearance through apparent negligence that we'll come on to shortly, you are going to be horrified to realize that no one still knows where he is. You're going to be distressed. You're going to be thinking about all the sweet little things about his nature, but not quite when it comes down to her. No, when it comes down to Dauphiné, she doesn't think, oh my God, let's be concerned about Elijah, what's happened to him. She instead starts by talking about him being a very, very troubled child with a lot of mental issues. I kid you not, just a lot of mental issues. How many? Oh, so many. How many? Just many, many mental issues. Could you describe them? He's just troubled. He's troubled. That's what I'm saying. He's troubled. He's got mental issues. He's just troubled with mental issues. Can you classify any of those? No, we've never actually sought any kind of help or professional engagement. I'm just saying that as his mother, I've defined him as being mentally unstable and very troubled. I'm just going to go and get a psychiatrist because I think we're going to be able to diagnose you as a massive narcissistic psychopath. Honestly, these women and men who do these things to children, they have so much in common with one another, don't they? And like I said, as opposed to thinking about what is going on here, that there is a child missing and it's meant to be a child related to her, she's just gonna pick him apart reputationally and tell the officers how horrible he was as a child. And she also goes on to say that Elijah likes to sneak out at night whilst they're both sleeping. I mean, let's just think about that for a minute. I've worked with quite a few five-year-olds in my life, and let me tell you, not one of those five-year-olds has ever been like, you know what I really like, Emma? No, go and tell me what you really like. I really, really like going out in the middle of the night, in the dark, by myself. Really? That sounds scary. Yeah, not for me, no. I really like going out in the massive world by myself with no lights, often no coat, and just wandering aimlessly. I find that I feel a real sense of comfort through such actions. Said no five-year-old. In the history of five-year-olds, five-year-olds are worried there are monsters under the bed. Five-year-olds think there are monsters in the closet. Five-year-olds hide under the covers when they hear a noise that they don't recognise. Five-year-olds are not like, hey, I'm just going to grab my stuff, go for a wander at 3 a.m. in the morning. But this is a story that she's going to tell. So he likes to sneak out at night. And also, apparently, he would steal things from the kitchen. Can I just throw it out there? Could it be food he was stealing from the kitchen, you horrible POS of a mother? We know he was starving. Maybe it was food. Maybe he's creeping around in the dark, if he ever was creeping around in the dark, actually in the kitchen to try to eat something because you were killing him. She also obviously thinks it's important to seem open and honest to the investigators. So she tells the detectives that she and her boyfriend were getting high on drugs a lot. And we see this a lot with guilty parties who really know that they are guilty of a far bigger crime. They'll take responsibility and accountability for something more palatable. So in this case, okay, the reason my story seems a little bit dodgy, the reason I seem a little bit suspicious is I'm actually hiding this truth. And this truth is, I'm a drug addict and I was taking drugs and I know I shouldn't have, so I'm a terrible person. Actually, the real crime is beneath that, far darker. Well, they think that by admitting this, the investigators will be like, oh, well, they're pretty honest. They told us about their drug use. Now, clearly, dyed-in-the-wool detectives, this immediately raises the alarm for them. But she's not bright enough to understand that and she's not schooled enough in this area. Now, she goes on to say that the day after he apparently wandered out of the house in September, he just never came back. That's right. Just one day. He wanders out of the house in September and then he just never came back. Just never came back. I mean, if that isn't the experience of most of us adult parents, I don't know what is. If you're not like, there's the door, go through it, let's see if you come back. If you don't, there's nothing I can do. At the end of the day, you're your own person. You're five. It's ludicrous. I mean, it's beyond neglectful. It's absolutely hateful on every single level. And this is something she's admitting to. Oh yeah, he wandered out of the house in September at some point and just never came back. But we were like, well, you know, he's free now. And she actually said, if I wasn't using, I would have reported him right away. So like, she's genuinely trying to use this as a reason. You know what? The thing is, what really bothers me about this situation is, if I hadn't been using drugs, I would have called the police and said, my five-year-old son has left the house and not come back. Sorry, just run me through that one again. I'm just saying, if I had not been a drug user, I would have been like, well, the police are not going to be happy with me using drugs. So I need to toss up whether I should risk that. Or whether I should just be like, you know, I know they're not going to be happy with me using drugs, so I just will go down the road of I won't tell them so they don't know that. And even though that means that my son has just wandered off and never come back, at least I won't have to risk their judgment when it comes down to the fact that I'm a drug user. So I thought that was probably the best course of action. I literally can't make sense of what you just said. Did you just say that you were taking drugs and therefore you didn't want the police to come because they would have judged you for taking drugs? I am saying that. It sounds like a bit of a sketchy story, but hearing you say it back to me, I think it's valid. I'm not saying that that's actually what she's saying here. She's probably saying at the end of the day, she'd been using drugs, so she wasn't really thinking straight, but come on. We're talking that this child has been missing for a long period of time at this point. So even when you got down from the high, just call in to the police and say, my son has disappeared. But instead she says, look, I was scared that DCYF would have got involved if they were aware of the drug use. Again, so you are worried that child services will get involved because you're on drugs. Yes, I am. What about when they find out?
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
How? You've not reported your whole child missing. You just let your child disappear. Well, I'm just saying, I thought I could do that after I got clean. Ugh, it's ludicrous. We all know it's ludicrous when I'm saying it. But again, these kind of individuals have excuses that know no bounds as long as they're not taking responsibility for reality. But she's concerned that because of their drug use, DCYF are going to get involved. That's going to be the least of her issues when we're dealing with a child who's just disappeared. She also then goes on to, again, sully his reputation, says he harms himself by scratching his own throat, by slapping himself. She says that she ends up getting depressed, and this led to her never leaving the house, and she was worried about her relationship with staff deteriorating. But she also makes it very clear to the police, you know, I never hurt him, and you just need to go ahead and search everywhere for him. I'd never hurt him. I'd never do anything to hurt him. Just going to throw this out. Just so you can explore it a little bit. You're saying you'd never hurt him. I would never hurt him. But you just didn't call us in after he wandered off out of the door in the night and never came back. Yeah, I mean, I would never personally hurt him. I mean, I can't actually say whether anybody else would hurt him when he's in the dark by himself wandering as a child and I'm not reporting it. I'm just saying I would never hurt him. Do you know what? This is when the thumbscrews should come out. They can't. We live in a completely different era. It's not the 15th century anymore, but I'm just saying this is possibly when in the past they should come out. But she then goes on about how she doesn't know where he is, and if she knew where he was, she'd tell them because all she wants is for him to be found. Now, bear in mind, in the other room, Staff's being interviewed, he tells exactly the same story about how Elijah just wandered away. So at this point, they're both held without bail and they're both transported back to New Hampshire to face questioning. Now, bear in mind, it is quite obvious how neglectful and horrific these human beings are without even knowing whether there is a body involved where Elijah is concerned. Now, you would imagine at this point, there'd be a moment of clarity for them both where they're like, when it comes down to the charges, we should probably say that we're quite guilty because at the end of the day, we just let him wander off into the night, never reported he disappeared and just, don't know, disappeared ourselves. But no, they both plead not guilty to the charges, but why would we expect accountability and responsibility from individuals like this? And it's worth noting as well, at this point, the other children were taken into state custody and foster care following the intervention by the police. Now, at this point, officers end up carrying out a search on Staff's truck. This has been abandoned at Morgan's son in Connecticut. Now, during that search, they did actually find a letter in the truck, and that letter includes this story about Elijah wandering off. So it seems that they've premeditated having to have this story, they planned this story as a cover-up. They also find trash, and that trash includes items that belong to Elijah, such as colouring books. Well, why are you throwing that away? Why are you throwing things away that a child would use? You know, there's one thing saying, oh, we just wandered off, we were smashed out of our heads and high, therefore we didn't do anything about it, and then we got scared and we left the area because we were worried for our own freedom. The fact that you have gathered things that belong to him and thrown them into the trash, you know he's not coming back. Why do you know he's not coming back? Because you are the reason he's not coming back. Now, during a search of the couple's residence, investigators also find a locked box with a filled methadone prescription for Dufanay, two bags with a brown powder substance consistent with heroin and fentanyl. Then in another locked box, they found a filled subscription for Staff's methadone and a medical card with Elijah's name on it. They also found an unsigned affidavit for his temporary guardianship to Dauphiné's sister, which is just heartbreaking because at the end of the day, that means that she would have been willing to take Elijah. He could have gone to a safe place. He could have been cared for because there was an unsigned affidavit for his temporary guardianship that could have been utilized to protect him and also to give Dauphiné that space that she so clearly desired. Now, when the investigators observed the room that belonged to the couple's daughter and then compared it to that of Elijah's room, they instantly felt Elijah's never coming back because he wasn't living there. Simple as that. Now, several days after this laughable interview, this is on October the 23rd, 2021, there's a police dog that's searching in Abington and it picks up the scent of a body in an area of Abington, Massachusetts. This is after credible information has led the investigators to a wooded area there. And it's at this point, really sadly, the body of Elijah Lewis is found and he's 5 years of age. And that's how he was disposed of, thrown away like he was rubbish. Now, although his body had decomposed to some degree, the investigators could see that his corpse showed extensive injuries, both recent and healed, including bruising. Also, he had bone-thin limbs. So on the 22nd of November, it was then that the chief medical examiner releases their findings after they've had a chance to really explore what had gone on for poor Elijah. Now, it turns out he was 3 feet, which is 91 centimetres tall. He weighed 19 pounds, that's 8.6 kilograms. Now, put into context, an average five-year-old boy, he'd be about 3'6", so that's 1.1 metre tall, and he'd be closer to 30 pounds, so 18 kilograms. The medical examiner also noticed that he had pressure ulcers. They're bed sores. So that indicates he was basically lying in one position for a very long period of time. He also had bruises and facial injuries. He'd been exposed to fentanyl. He had substantial dental decay. He had scalp and facial injuries consistent with physical abuse. So clearly the death was ruled a homicide. And the medical examiner listed violence and neglect as the cause of his death. Also, just to be clear, the presence of pressure ulcers in a young mobile child is deeply unusual. And indeed, the medical examiner pointed to this and said this should not be the case with children who should be mobile and moving around. And just to add to that, one of the open infected sores was down to the muscle and bone. And one medical expert said this, skin breakdown or bed sores is not something you'd ever see in a healthy five-year-old. That speaks to being tied down or being so weak, so malnourished, that he was unable to move at the end of his life. That's what Elijah suffered, guys. That's what he was dealing with. He was either tied down or he was so unwell he lay in one position to a point where he got an ulcer that went down to the bone. Now, the last independent sighting of Elijah was about a month before he was reported missing. Now, prosecutors believe that he actually died in September 2021. Now, as the investigation goes on, they learn that before their arrest, Dauphiné and staff had actually thrown their phones into a river, which is just the kind of action of an innocent person. I don't know about you, if the police come in to have a chat with me, first thing I do, bob down to the sea or bob down to river, just chuck all my technology in, nothing to see here. If there's nothing to see here, I've done nothing wrong. I mean, literally, you may as well have the word guilty literally tattooed on your forehead. Now, in spite of the fact that they've gone ahead and done that, they do manage to find Staps. Now, Dauphiné's was never recovered, but they have enough with his technology. Now, upon searching through the history of text messages and social media communications, the investigators learn the horrific trail that evidences what they did to that child. In fact, they found messages where Dauphiné's told Staff, he said he wants food and he wants me to stop starving him because it's not nice. I mean, she literally wrote that. Well, you know what? A five-year-old has got a measure on you because you're absolutely right. He would want food. He would want to stop being starved. And it would mean that you weren't nice if you were going ahead and doing those things to him. This child has got more understanding of human behavior than Dauphiné herself. She also writes to Stapp, I'm going to kill him. And I mean it. I hit him in the head with a shower rod. That's all I did. Can you imagine doing that to a five-year-old kid? Clouting them with the shower rod. And then she adds to that, that's all I did. That's all I did. And then she said, just whoop the maggot. Can you believe that she's talking about a five-year-old little boy with special needs at this moment in time? They also found messages that showed Staff texted Dauphiné to give Elijah more food and said, you need to fatten him up. So he's obviously noticing that he's being starved. And he also is thinking to himself, I don't want him to present this way because obviously if Elijah has the prying eyes of the authorities on him at some point, if someone discovers Elijah in that state, they are going to be blamed for that maltreatment. So he's saying, listen, we need to fatten him up. And that's actually texted, you need to fatten him up. Now, on one message where, again, she's complaining that Elijah wants food because he's starving, guys, because he's starving, Staff writes back, yes, he is a POS big time. Wow, I cannot stand that boy. The kid's five.
These are two grown adults, and they are talking about this little boy in this way. And according to some of the text messages, there was that concern that Elijah needed to get healthy enough because the couple then could safely leave him with another relative. Bear in mind that affidavit that hadn't been signed. Clearly, there was a relative in mind. It's just so sad that that never played out. So staff actually says to her, maybe let him sleep, maybe feed him. And Dauphiné responds, this fucking kid deserves nothing. If only we could treat her the same way as she has treated Elijah. Because even in the system, even when you're imprisoned, let's be clear, you get a lot more than nothing. And it just breaks my heart that Elijah wasn't afforded just the very bare minimum in this situation. So this plaint's a clear picture of the abuse, the violence, the neglect which Elijah's clearly been subjected to. Now we get to April the 15th, 2022. This is when a grand jury in Hillsborough County, New Hampshire, hand down the formal indictment against Danielle Dauphiné. So at this point, she faced counts of first degree murder, which is purposeful killing, second degree murder, which is reckless extreme indifference, three counts of witness tampering, as well as the previous charges of child endangerment. Now this indictment was actually accompanied by a detailed affidavit outlining the abuse, the messages, and the changes to Elijah's routine over time, just demonstrating how he was absolutely brutalized by this couple. The prosecutors believed that Elijah died in September 2021. They then believe that the couple put his body in a container, brought him to the Massachusetts Park. This is where staff dug a hole and buried him. Now, she stood before Judge Lisa English. And at that point, does she plead guilty? Of course she doesn't. She says she's not guilty. However, on September the 29th of 2022, staff decides to take a plea deal. So in this plea deal, he admits that he did assault Elijah, that he did help hide his body after Elijah had been murdered, and that he lied to investigators, that he destroyed evidence. So he's then allowed to plead guilty to manslaughter, second degree assault, falsifying physical evidence, witness tampering. And for that, he ends up getting sentenced to 22 to 45 years in prison. So the state basically argued that staff was an enforcer of Dauphiné's punishment. So he did nothing to protect Elijah. He actually helped her carry out the horrible punishments she decided on. Now, the defense argued that he was manipulated by her and overwhelmed by the household. I mean, give me strength. You manipulated to help kill a child? Methinks not. But again, the defense didn't really have anywhere to go. They got him a deal that to some degree means that at least Elijah is afforded some justice. This guy's going to be in prison for a very, very long time. Now, throughout 2023 and early 2024, multiple hearings were held, and Dauphiné's defense, they filed lots of motions, including challenging the admissibility of some digital messages, also challenging cell phone records, also challenging the timeline of death. Sorry? Yeah, we're challenging the timeline of death. So how are you doing that? We're just saying that the timeline you've decided existed didn't exist. Are you saying that your defendant didn't actually get involved in the death of the child? We're not saying that. We're saying what an issue with the timeline. Are you saying that your defendant did kill the child? We are saying that we have an issue with the timeline, and the timeline needs to be looked at very, very clearly and sensibly to see whether we can get our client off for a technicality that we haven't figured out yet. Just timeline. I'm going to keep saying the word timeline. But anyway, that's another thing they bring in. Also, they attempted to reduce the first degree murder charge. Now, Danielle Dauphiné, she basically paints herself as an abused and abandoned child who'd never been given the tools to parent. Loads of people don't get the tools to parent love. They're brilliant parents. It's called not being an inhumane POS. You didn't get a memo on that though, did you, sweetheart? Now, she also claims that addiction and trauma had shaped the choices she made as an adult. Nobody is traumatized to a degree where they think it's appropriate to tell the police that a child left their property at 5 years of age and never came back.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
and they just didn't bother going and finding them. Instead, they went back to the house and got absolutely smashed on drugs, as they happened to do when he disappeared. Because that's what they did. Literally, after he apparently just wandered off into the night, she went in and was like, oh, I can't cope with this. Give me a hit of heroin. Because clearly, she was obviously someone who was deeply traumatised, who'd had her choices shaped as an adult by her trauma as a child. I mean, give me the tissues, because I ain't going to cry you a river. I'm probably not even going to have to dab one of my eyes, because I know that what you are saying is absolute lies beyond measure. Now, of course, the prosecutors say this is not true. There's no independent evidence to substantiate much of her narrative. She's a liar, basically. Now, the prosecution, they argued that she starved Elijah. She denied him medical care. She used fentanyl to sedate or control him. She lied repeatedly, as we know, to avoid detection. She engaged in psychological projection without a shadow of a doubt. She called her son, as I said earlier on, a serial killer whilst abusing him. Now, we get to September the 26th, 2024, when Dauphiné's obviously seen how compelling the evidence against her is. And then she thinks to herself, this is not a guilty plea. Is that a good idea? And it seems not. So she agrees to plead guilty to second degree murder and also two counts of witness tampering. This meant that that first degree murder charge was dropped in exchange for her plea. But that didn't mean that she wasn't going to get an extremely severe sentence. She would. And she deserved to. So Judge Lisa English did go ahead and accept a plea. And on October the 25th, 2024, the sentencing hearing took place. Now, at the hearing, the court was literally packed with Elijah's relatives, reporters, community members. And the prosecution said this: she killed him hour by hour, day by day, month by month. They're basically talking about murder in slow motion there. They showed photos of him over a 16-month period getting progressively thinner. And then in the last photo, literally one of his eyes was shut. Prosecutors also talked about how the mother in this case just shifted blame and responsibility to the biological father and to other people. And the prosecutor said she did nothing to help Elijah. They requested 55 years to life. Now, it was Judge Charles Temple who actually gave the sentencing. And during this, they said that they systematically abused Elijah and said that you knew exactly what you were doing. You starved him, you drugged him, you isolated him, you buried him in a shallow grave. He said that she had shown complete disregard for the life of a child. Now, bear in mind, the defense have to argue for her benefit. They said, look, she struggled with mental health. She lacked support. They emphasized how Elijah had serious behavioral issues. But with respect, you would have, having had his experiences. They also tried to allege that Staff was the more violent person and that Danielle Dauphiné regretted failing her son. I don't think any of us buy into that. Now, the defense asked for 35 years, which is the minimum term. However, it turns out that rightfully, those mitigations were overshadowed by evidence. They also argued that Dauphiné's texts were sent out of apparent desperation because Elijah showed aggressive behavior and she couldn't manage that behavior and she was taking care of another child. And another mitigation they tried to push forward was that her ex-husband wouldn't provide his insurance information for her to seek help. I don't know whether that was true, but if that was true, it doesn't seem right in any way, shape or form. Now, during the victim impact statements read out, Elijah's father, Timothy Lewis, described his son's early years, talked about the guilt of being unable to protect him, also talked about the pain of knowing his son died suffering, and then he called Danielle Dauphiné's actions unforgivable, also questioned how someone could harm a five-year-old boy. Also, a victim's advocate, a woman called Amy Cirullo, they read out loud a victim impact statement from Elijah Lewis's relatives, and obviously they all expressed devastation that this had happened because there were willing people who would have taken Elijah. It's as simple as that. Good human beings who cared enough for that little boy when others failed to do so. When it came down to her sentencing, she was given 53 years to life in prison and she deserves every single one of them. Basically, it's a life sentence. She's going to be around 91 years of age at her first parole eligibility, so she ain't seeing free sunlight ever again. One of the people who spoke to the cameras after this sentencing was Elijah's aunt, and she said that she's glad. She hopes that she's going to die behind bars. She described her as a snake and a chameleon, and I think that that's a really good description. Now, after the legal proceedings, there was an investigation. So the state of New Hampshire, they ended up reaching a settlement with the family of Elijah Lewis. So his father, Timothy Lewis, he filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the state. He alleged that DCFY failed to act when his son's safety was called into question. He claimed in the lawsuit that DCYF was negligent and failed to keep his son safe while he lived with his mother. Now, that settlement actually reached $2.25 million. And under the terms of that settlement, the state doesn't have to admit any wrongdoing or unlawful conduct. The money has been split 30% to Timothy Lewis and 70% into a trust for Elijah's half-siblings. And this case, understandably, has prompted a lot of public and media focus on how DCYF handled reports, risk assessments, and also whether internal protocols were followed needs to be investigated even more so, because we want to prevent these kind of things happening again. When it came down to doing something beautiful for this lost boy, a candlelight vigil was held on the 25th of October 2021 at Watson Park in Merrimack, and literally hundreds of people gathered. They held candles, they had a framed photo of Elijah, and his aunt, the lovely MJ Morrison, spoke. She described how his big brown eyes and dimples just stole the hearts of people all over the world. And that's so true. When children like this are lost, when they deserve so much more, the people of the world who care about the legacy of these children, we cradle them in our memories, in our minds, in our hearts. We take them with us. All of you will take Elijah with you from this moment onwards. You will remember him. You will remember his story. You will tell his story. And that means that even though he is dead in one aspect of this world, he's still very much alive in so many of our minds. Also, I found a post on a Facebook memorial group named Just Did for Elijah, and it had been made by a relative who wrote, "Eli, you did not deserve any of this. You are so loved by every single person in this group. Your beautiful smile, big brown eyes, perfect dimples. You will never be forgotten." And he won't, will he? He won't be forgotten. I will forget her. I will forget Dauphiné and Staff. They're just two monsters. But I won't forget Eli. And this video is dedicated to him. Fly high, sweetheart. You're free now. See you again next time, guys. Be safe.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.